This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Coyotes are no strangers to eastern North Carolina. They're highly adaptable and thrive in forest areas, on agricultural lands, and even urban environments. But this isn't a feature on coyotes. It's really about the endangered red wolf. Red wolves were almost hunted to extinction until human intervention saved the species from disappearing altogether. Red wolves and coyotes look alike, though there are some subtle differences. But as far as their populations, coyotes have taken over a five-county region of northeastern North Carolina, also known as the Red Wolf Recovery Area. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Red Wolf Recovery Program Coordinator, David Rabin.
Coyotes have been well documented in all 100 counties in North Carolina, and it appears that the population has certainly grown over the last 20 or 30 years.
On the other hand, the only wild population of red wolves left in the world exists in Beaufort, Dare, Hyde, Terrell, and Washington counties. Red wolves were put on the endangered species list in 1967, and by the 1980s, they were thought to be extinct. In an effort to save the red wolf, a captive breeding program was started in 1981. U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials decided northeastern North Carolina provided good habitat, a good prey base for the animals, low human population density, and at the time, no coyotes.
One of the problems that the animal had experienced in its last days in the wild back in the 60s, it was basically hybridizing with the coyote. It was reproducing and creating hybrid animals. So there was a threat of genetic swamping of the red wolf. So that was why North Carolina was chosen. It offered those features, those characteristics that would have made for hopefully to allow a population to be established.
Thanks to the recovery program, red wolf populations were on the rebound. But as coyotes have spread into northeastern North Carolina, red wolf numbers have declined. Rabin estimates that less than 100 exist in the wild.
I mean, there's all sorts of types of mortality that occur every year, everything from just natural death, old age, some disease, getting hit by a vehicle. Gunshot mortality appears to be one that's contributing to the population decline. It's certainly, in terms of mortality, that is our single greatest source of mortality right now.
A total of 20 red wolves have died from confirmed gunshots since 2008. A couple weeks ago, two red wolves wearing radio collars were found dead in Washington County. According to a press release from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, both red wolves died of suspected gunshot wounds. The first wolf was discovered on October 28th, and the other 2 days later, both within a quarter mile of each other. Executive Director of the Red Wolf Coalition, Kim Wheeler, says it hasn't been determined if the latest red wolf deaths are connected.
It's an ongoing criminal investigation, so we're hoping that when they begin to figure out what happened, knocking on doors, looking at the evidence, that they'll be able to make that determination, but there's no way to know that.
It's also unclear at this time if the most recent red wolf deaths were a result of the nighttime hunting rule approved by the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission on August 1st. Red Wolf Recovery Program Coordinator David Rabin.
We don't have any data that would suggest one way or another. That's partly because of it's hard to necessarily pinpoint a time of death that would imply that it was shot at night.
Red wolves are often mistaken for coyotes. According to senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, Sierra Weaver, there are some slight differences. Coyotes are smaller, have pointed and erect ears, and a long, slender snout. They also have long, bushy tails. She says the similarities are difficult to distinguish, especially at night.
It makes a almost impossible ability to tell apart red wolves and coyotes entirely impossible. So we're compounding an existing problem for an already highly, highly imperiled species.
The Southern Environmental Law Center is a regional nonprofit that shapes, implements, and enforces environmental laws and policies. Currently, a federal lawsuit is pending where the organization sued the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission for causing the illegal take of red wolves.
There's not much that has gone on in the court case so far. We have filed our complaint and we are awaiting the state's answer.
In 2012, another lawsuit challenging the night hunting rule was brought up by the Southern Environmental Law Center. It resulted in a ban on coyote hunting at night last fall. As wildlife officials conduct an investigation on the two latest red wolf deaths, a reward of $21,000 is being offered for information leading to an arrest and criminal conviction. So far, Red Wolf Recovery Program Director Kim Wheeler says no one has come forward with any information.
I always hope that as the reward pot gets bigger, that it'll loosen some lips. We're just really trying to talk to people, let them know if they don't already know that this happened and that it is an endangered species and it is against the law. And if they, you know, hear anything, to contact the law enforcement contacts on the press release.
For more information on the North Carolina Fish and Wildlife Service's Red Wolf Recovery Program and to see pictures of the Red Wolf, visit publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the Craven Community College's Explorations in the Arts. The series continues on Wednesday, November 20th at 7:30 p.m. at Orringer Auditorium with special guest artist William Henry Curry, composer and resident conductor of the North Carolina Symphony. Public Radio East's Mac McKee spoke with Mr. Curry this week about the evening of music and interviews that will focus on Maestro Curry's life as a composer.
Maestro, welcome to the Down East Journal.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please give our listeners a preview of what to expect for that evening.
Well, I was asked to present a topic that might have some kind of interest to your general music fan. And for, 20 years or so, I've been really curious about the fact that for most people, including professional musicians, the art of composition is a total mystery. I mean, people just assume that the muse or God sits on the composer's shoulder and whispers into their ear, now this note, now that note. And I thought it might be interesting, and our host there said that they agreed it might be interesting for me to talk about my process. At the same time, of course, I talk about the process of many of the great composers that I've worked with and some of the dead guys, too.
Now, do you see this event next week combining the best elements of music education and entertainment, not only appealing to the aficionado of classical music, but for the layman as well?
Well, everything I do really is meant to be educating and entertaining at the same time. You know, for a while in the 70s, I was mentored by Arthur Fiedler, who was at the time the conductor of the Boston Pops. And he said, as far as programming, give the people something they know and they like. At the same time, give them a piece which they should know and which you believe they will also like. So you're always teaching. At the same time, you are just having fun with the music.
It would not only be you that evening, but you'll have a pianist and a vocalist there, will you not?
Yes. Rosalind Sorrell is one of the finest sopranos I've ever worked with. She's a versatile artist, actress, singer, writer, and Nancy Whalen is a choral director, pianist, and again, an extraordinary musician. They're going to be presenting a song, orchestral and vocal composition I wrote, and we'll be talking about how I put this together.
Maestro, who are your favorite composers, and who inspired you to start composing music?
Well, if I had to name one composer out of dozens and dozens that are my soulmates, I'd say Mozart. I consider him to be the greatest apostle of musical joy. There's something optimistic and everything is right with the world about his music that I found really compelling. And as far as compositional heroes, I would say Aaron Copland. He meant a great deal to me from middle school on. I had a chance to work with him later on as a young man in my 20s, and I had a chance to spend some private time with him, and he was wonderfully encouraging and insightful about what it meant to be a composer.
Now, do you come from a musical family yourself, Maestro?
I do not. We believe that music skipped a generation. My grandparents were wonderful singers and organists, and my parents were only, they played piano by ear like most people of their generation, and we can't really figure out what happened. My brother and I have both been in classical music as professionals for 35 years. He's been in the Cleveland Orchestra, has played with the New York Philharmonic, Detroit Symphony. I've conducted some of the truly great orchestras of America and the world. And we find our love of music to be a calling. We were introduced to it, and from that point on, there was no looking back.
Now, Maestro, do you see yourself primarily as a composer, conductor, musical historian, or a combination of all three?
In a sense, a combination of all three. When I was in eighth grade, everyone had to write some kind of book report. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I've lost mine, but I certainly remember what the topic was. It was, I want to be Leonard Bernstein. He, of course, had these young people's concerts on primetime TV, if you can believe that, back in the day, 50s, 60s, and early 70s. And he struck me as being so admirable in that he didn't want to be pigeonholed. He composed, he conducted, he played the piano, he wrote about music, he wrote poetry. And I was so intoxicated by music that it occurred to me that I wanted to know everything about music. And the only way you can do that is to do these various disciplines yourself. And so I've been playing catch-up with Leonard Bernstein for almost 40 years, and but yet it's made me a better all-around musician.
Now, Maestro, how would you encourage parents who have a child interested in learning more about studying and performing the classics?
I think the best way to encourage a child is to show how much you respect and love. That's the important thing, how much you love the music. And just play it around the house various times of the day. Get them used to hearing it. My parents introduced me to jazz in a lovely way. They brought down all these 78 RPM records from the attic one evening, and they talked about the music of Ellington and Benny Goodman and how much it meant to them then and when they were kids. And so you share your enthusiasm with something, a young person will remember that. So just a case of playing the music around the house, maybe telling a couple stories about the composers, and hopefully the kid will have a kind of curiosity that will take off by itself.
Well, Maestro Curry, hopefully on the next week you'll inspire a young person to become a composer just like you.
Well, Ray Little would make me happier. I think it's the most fun in the world is to try to create things that only you can create, and of course, I love sharing with people the things I love most in life, and that would include music for sure.
Once again, Craven Community College is presenting Exploration in the Arts, and PRE is, of course, sponsoring that as well, featuring special artist William Henry Curry, composer and resident conductor for the North Carolina Symphony. That's coming up Wednesday, November 20th at Orringer Auditorium, 7:30 p.m. on the campus of Craven Community College. Maestro, thank you so much for being our guest today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with 3HC, Home Health and Hospice Care. Over 30 years of providing skilled nursing, physical and occupational therapy, speech pathology, hospice and private duty nursing care to essentially homebound patients throughout Eastern North Carolina. 3HC, Home Health and Hospice Care, online at 3hc.org.
Life has enough drama.
But other ducks are going to look at our kid and think, that duck is uglier than a mud fence.
Ow.
Somebody's been beating that duck with the ugly stick. People are going to look at our kid and yell, here it comes, Doc!
Ow.
And reality.
All the hot air around here comes from old Mr. Big Pants.
Oh,
over there.
Please.
Find a way to forget your troubles and gather some friends around the radio this weekend.
Saturday evening at 6 o'clock on all of the PRE stations.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Here in the early fall, one of my favorite ornamental plants is putting on a show. The plant itself, well, it's not much to look at, but the berries it produces. Oh my heavens, I don't know what it is about them, but I find them absolutely, well, beautiful. The plant is the beauty berry, and it's native to woodlands here in the southeastern United States. Beauty berry is in the Calycarpa species. And Calycarpa, well, it means beautiful fruit, which is where the name beauty berry comes from. The plant grows in light shade, often right along the edge of woodlands, or maybe on the side of the road. You can see beauty berry as you drive into the aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores. that are growing along both sides of the road. How will you know? Well, the most spectacular purple berries are showing right now. They're not just any purple. I can't even describe the purple, but they're wonderful. There's also a large plant in the parking lot at the aquarium and some cultivated species up closer to the building. These shrubs grow 4 to 6 feet tall and wide, but can get up to 8 or 10 feet tall under favorable growing condition. They develop a somewhat rounded shape with long arching branches and light green foliage. There's nothing particularly attractive about them during the summer. They're nice, they just don't jump out at you. In the summer, however, they start getting clusters of tiny pink, lavenderish colored flowers, followed by green berries, and these are at each and every leaf node during the summer. Again, you probably won't notice them much, but when you get to late August, those berries turn purple, or in some cultivated species, white, but I like the purple ones. Because of these wonderful purple berries in early fall, these plants make a great addition to a landscape for an area that's starting to lose interest this time of year. The bright metallic purple berries, well, they stand out like a forsythia does in the spring, only these are doing it in the fall. Because flowers and berries are produced on new growth, you want to prune these in late winter. That way you're not pruning off next year's berries. You can use either a thinning type pruning method or a heavy cutback to near the ground. A severe pruning on vigorous plants that are grown in full sun creates large rounded shrubs with many long shoots that flower heavily. Luckily, there are no serious insect or disease problems with beautyberry here in North Carolina, so it might be worth a try in your garden. I guarantee it'll catch your eye when those berries ripen next fall. So go out and see if you see any beautyberry in the landscapes around you within the next few weeks. The birds will be eating the berries later this winter. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The Wright brothers were the first in flight, but not if you listen to the recent going-ons in Connecticut, which has been advancing the claim that Gustav Whitehead beat the brothers to the sky 2 years earlier. Connecticut claims a photograph, actually a photograph inside a photograph, backs up their assertion. So nearly 110 years after the Wrights' flight, the debate over the first flight lingers on. However, you might be able to blame the Wright brothers for the confusion. The iconic photographs of their December 1903 flight weren't seen until several years later, all in efforts to preserve the Wrights' investment in conquering flight. It's detailed and part of a 2009 book by an ECU professor. George Olson spoke with author Larry Tice about his book Conquering the Sky and has this, which originally aired in December 2009.
Our license plates are inscribed First in Flight, and that settles it, right? The Wright brothers were the first to send a powered heavier-than-air craft into the skies, but despite all we know and that iconic photo of the Wrights' Kitty Hawk flyer skimming above the Outer Banks dunes, Larry Tice will tell you there's still debate about who got to the skies first.
In fact, I spoke in Washington recently, and I said, you know, if you go stand beside of the Wright brothers' first flyer, the Kitty Hawk flyer, at the Air and Space Museum today, just listen to what people are saying. Somebody will come in with a French accent, and they'll say, no. Somebody will arrive there from Brazil and say, no, they don't tell this story straight. No, it's incorrect.
You can blame the fact there's still some type of debate going on with the Wright brothers themselves.
They were absolutely certain, and they were living in a time in which people stole ideas from other people and went out and filed patents, basically taking away the rights from inventors. And they were very much afraid that if somebody saw them fly, if somebody even saw their machine or saw a picture of their machine, that their secrets about how to fly would be stolen immediately.
Which is why that 1903 photo we're so familiar with today was never published until 1908. Another reason some question still remains in some people's minds again falls back on the actions of the Wright brothers. They discovered the secrets of flight in 1902 during glider experiments on the Outer Banks. At that point, they made a switch from inventors to entrepreneurs.
After their flights in 1903, and they realized that they had a real flying machine, the first thing they wanted to do was to sell it. And so if you want to sell something, this being America, the first thing you do is get a patent. And so in early 1903, before they had the powered flight, they went for a patent from the U.S. Patent Office. It took 3 years for them to get the patent so that they could protect what they had discovered. As soon as they had the patent, which was 1906, then they wanted to sell the plane. They tried to sell the plane in 1907 unsuccessfully. It was not until January of 1908 that they had two contracts to build airplanes. One was with the U.S. government. Another contract was with a business syndicate in France. But the condition of the contract was that they had to fly for an hour. They had to fly with a passenger. And they had to fly at a speed of 125 miles an hour.
And that was the reason for their return to the Outer Banks in 1908. The Wrights had flown successfully in their native Ohio, but to achieve the parameters they had to accomplish in order to sell their invention, they wanted to experiment in the favorable winds and soft place to fall provided in North Carolina. Talk of flight was all the rage at the time, and with the Wright brothers' prior claims of flight, their arrival on the Outer Banks also prompted the arrival of the press, eager to prove or disprove the Wrights' claims.
But once the reporters arrived, desperately trying to get the story and get the story right, they were constantly being deceived by the Wright brothers, who basically would say to the reporters, if the reporters arrived at Kill Devil Hills, "We won't fly as long as you're here." And so the reporters would retreat from the flying field in fear that the Wright brothers wouldn't fly.
And that produced some spectacularly inaccurate reporting. There were eyewitness accounts of Wright brothers' flights in 1908 at a time when the plane hadn't even been constructed yet. And even when they did position themselves to see something, such as on May 14, 1908, they often missed crucial and obvious details.
So Wilbur took off and was flying in circles very beautifully. And the reporters didn't see him anymore, so they thought, well, he must have landed. And so they left. They went back to Manio to write their stories. They wrote all of their stories, and they said, this morning the Wright brothers had a passenger flight, and they said that Charles Furness was on the flight. And in the afternoon, Wilbur did his long-awaited distance flight, but it was only 8 minutes. It was not 1 hour long. That's what they knew. They wrote those stories. They sent that out. But then in the evening, the lifesavers again showed up and said, "Oh, Mr. Wright crashed. He tore his machine to smithereens, and he was hurt."
Wilbur Wright suffered only minor injuries in that crash, just bruises, according to the brothers' own written records. Despite the inaccuracies, the reporters did come up with one piece of indisputable proof for the Wright brothers' claims, a single photograph taken at some distance of the Wright brothers' aircraft in flight, a photograph that was seen by the public before the now iconic 1903 photo made its way to print. The Wright brothers left the Outer Banks convinced they could meet the demands of their sales contract, and they did, with public demonstrations by Wilbur in France in August and Orville in Virginia in September of that year, making them the preeminent aeronauts of their time. But to some degree, their fears about others stealing their ideas came to fruition, and within a short amount of time, others were making airplanes of similar or superior capabilities than the Wrights. And with that, what they had left was their claim of first in flight with a heavier-than-air craft, and that was a topic of debate in the U.S. until the 1940s. Larry Tice says their secretive ways, anchored in their entrepreneurial hopes, clashed with their engineering achievement and delayed the acclaim that was deserved.
In my analysis, they decided in 1902, after they figured out how to fly, that they really wanted to follow in the footsteps of Henry Ford and Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Edison and other inventors who were able to transform their inventions into making money. And I think that's what animated the Wright brothers. And So if their goal was to make money and to sell their invention, they did exactly what they should have done. But if their goal was to get credit for making the first powered flying machine that was a controlled machine, then they didn't play it well.
Larry Tice is the Wilbur and Orville Wright Distinguished Professor of History at East Carolina University and the author of Conquering the Sky, The Secret Flights of the Wright Brothers and Kitty Hawk, published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm George Olson.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features you'd like to hear on the Downeast Journal, you can drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.